Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. We're recording this on August 17th, 2016. We awoke to the news that the Donald Trump campaign has decided to yet again reset itself, reboot itself, rework itself with the news that unpaid campaign chairman Paul Manafort had a slush fund of $12 million sitting in some office in Kiev, courtesy of his client, Viktor Yanukovych, who, among other wonderful things that he's done in life, poisoned his rival with dioxin before the 2004 elections. Really a nice guy, all around good guy, Paul Manafort, real credit to our democracy and our civilization. Well, so apparently he is being kicked upstairs, shunted aside, and the most parodic thing that could possibly have happened, self-parodic, ridiculous, preposterous thing has happened, which is a merger between the Trump campaign and the news organization, unfortunately named and run in the memory of our old friend Andrew Breitbart. Steve Bannon, a financier and one-time movie producer. One of the movies that he produced was a film version by the Broadway director Julie Taymor of Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, which features, among other things, a rival to the title character being served to his mistress in a pie, in a cut, chopped up and cooked in a cannibalistic pie. So apparently Steve Bannon has done this to Paul Manafort, chopped him up and put him in a pie, and is now, you know, feeding him to whoever it is that Paul Manafort would be fed to. So the merger of the Trump campaign with the propagandists, not only of the Trump campaign, but of the alt-right, and all that is now complete. Middle of August, 80 days to go to the election, down 8 or 9 points in the polls, down by 8 or 9 points in almost every single important swing state. And according to many reckonings, Hillary already has 270 plus electoral votes in the bag, which would mean that the election is over, barring some wild exogenous event. And since the only exogenous event so far has been the replacement of Paul Manafort by Steve Bannon, one really doubts that the exogenous events are going to serve Donald Trump well. So with me, Noah Rothman, assistant online editor of Commentary, and our radio producer, our podcast producer, with the board in front of him. And we're going to try not to do pegging, and we're not going to cough, and we're not going to make noise. I'm getting emails about how it's disgusting to hear me cough, so I'm going to try not to cough. And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor, sitting, trying desperately not to do what they call pegging. I don't even know what that is. It's when you go or something like that, and it makes your...
You just did it.
I did it. So that was pegging, and Abe is not going to do it, right, Abe? You promise?
This is a no pegging zone.
No pegging. Okay. So that is the... We tee up in this circumstance where when you think that the most ridiculous thing that could possibly have happened has already happened, and then a new ridiculous thing happens. So, Noah, is there anything that can be said about this campaign shift that is even remotely positive about the future of the Trump campaign?
Well, that's a good question. I think they undid a lot of work they were doing to trying to project a new face. We had another teleprompter speech on Monday about quote unquote national security, which was much more about immigration. It was a reasonable speech, I suppose, although I wasn't a huge fan of it. But if you're a fan of boilerplate Trumpism on paper, the speech was fine. He delivered something else yesterday, another prepared speech. It was supposed to be a rally. It was a pretty decent speech. reaching out to some demographics that they need and they are not getting, although this was also a flawed effort, but it was an effort nonetheless. And also, we have some news that they're finally investing in some campaign advertising. The first Trump general election ads that will be airing in swing states are going to start to go up next week. This was all really undone by this campaign quote-unquote shakeup, which is really the worst of all worlds. Real quick, this Manafort thing, he's not off the team. He's still maintaining his role. He's still campaign chairman. And we had today a story from the Associated Press doing an investigation into Manafort's background, noted that he worked with a lobbying firm linked, ironically, to Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta's brother, where they funneled $2.2 million from pro-Russian Ukrainian political parties to Washington lobbying firms in violation of the law. None of this was disclosed. Manafort was never registered as a foreign agent, which is something you have to do to comport with a 1938 act preventing Nazi infiltration of the American government. And he's flirting with a felony. The Trump campaign will have to answer to this. The Trump campaign now owns Breitbart, and Breitbart has a real checkered history when it comes to race relations. You have to look at their content, and you see quite a bit of stuff that really reflects the alt-right thinking, which is extremely racially insensitive. They own all of this, so any sort of pivot that they were attempting to make is undermined now by this big splashy shakeup that resets the clock back to the primary. And I have to think that resetting the clock back to the primary is what the primary candidate here wants. The principal of this campaign wants to go back to the old days where he didn't feel quote-unquote boxed in by people who were trying to turn him into something he's not.
You know what else I like about this, the new campaign shakeup? Who remembers when Corey Lewandowski was first accused of manhandling Michelle Fields? And Trump's response was, look, it would be so easy for me to turn my back on him, but the one thing I am is loyal. Trump is loyal, loyalty above all else. Lewandowski's long since been kicked to the curb, and now it's Manafort's turn.
Gee, Abe, and where was Michelle Fields working at the time that she was manhandled by Corey Lewandowski?
I believe at a place called Breitbart.
Breitbart, that's right. The Breitbart.com. And, of course, there was the revelation by Ben Shapiro, I believe, after the fact of the emails sent between Matt Boyle and Corey Lewandowski, Matt Boyle of Breitbart and Corey Lewandowski, in which Matt Boyle says, what are we going to do about this? And, ooh, and just giving you a heads up, and this is real trouble, blah, blah, blah. We don't know what to do. And, of course, Breitbart did not stand by its reporter, which is not a surprising thing to happen for something that is neither a news organization nor a reputable place that employs human beings, but is totally consistent with being a shill hack junk site for the Trump campaign. And this very sleazy guy, Steve Bannon, is now running a presidential campaign. On Twitter this morning, I went into a series of analogies in which I said putting him in charge of the campaign is like putting the guy who painted four dogs playing poker in charge of the National Gallery, or like putting E.L. James, the author of 50 Shades of Grey, in charge of the Nobel Prize for Literature. I mean, it is, you know, this is the most important political job in the world every 4 years for a staffer, and a guy who has never run a political campaign yet again is now going to run a political campaign. So it's the death wish of Trump to embrace, you know, what makes him comfortable is the tragedy that we face here, because basically, last year, when everybody was saying he was going to blow himself up and it would all fade by the time the primary started, this is what we thought was going to happen. What we're seeing now is what we thought would happen in December. But it didn't happen in December, and it didn't happen in January. It happened exactly at the worst possible moment for the Republican Party, for the conservative movement, and for the country as a whole. Because what has happened here and the timing of it means that there is no going back, there is no changing the dynamic, There is no getting another candidate. There is no mitigation of the damage that the top of the ticket will do in the Republican elections to the lower parts of the ticket, the Senate and the House races and other races. That's not to say that that individual candidates can't survive the tsunami if they run good campaigns. In 1972, Nixon won by 23 points, and the Democrats picked up a net 2 seats in the Senate. It can be done. But there is nothing to be done about this. And so those of us who were screaming in November and December, wake up, you know, aside from every moral and political and ideological question raised by Trump, there was also the practical question that he was unsuited to the presidency and inexperienced, and that everything that he was doing that was working for the primary was going to be incredibly destructive in the general election was unheeded by the Republican primary electorate. And Hillary Clinton is now the beneficiary of the ultimate perfect storm, right? Which basically began that 4 days of the Democratic convention were a perfect act of goading. The whole thing was designed to goad Trump into doing what he did. It wasn't clear what speech was going to push his button, whether it was going to be Michelle's speech or Barack's speech or Bill's speech or Hillary's speech. As it turns out, it was Khazir Khan's speech. But the entire convention was basically a giant goad, and he fell for it, and he went exactly where he was not supposed to go, and he has blown himself up. And once again, you look back and you say there were people who said that this was going to be exactly the horror scenario that we were going to face. And there were people who said, no, everything's different. He's bringing out new voters. He's this, he's that, blah, blah, blah. Doing so well. And it was all basically nonsense, because he got 14 million votes in the primaries, and he needs four times that or more to win, and he has done absolutely nothing to reach out beyond those 14%, including mostly to the other 17 million Republican primary voters who didn't vote for him. So forget outreach to non-Republicans and to independents and to unaffiliated voters and all that. He has done almost nothing except for putting out a list of 11 Supreme Court justices to reach out to them, to bring them in. So right now, Noah and I have a little disagreement. Noah thinks that in the end he'll get 90% of self-described
Close.
Republicans.
Close.
Right now he's somewhere between 70 and 80%. I don't see how it grows. I mean, I know people hate Hillary, and they're going to hate Hillary, and Hillary is going to make them angry. But there will be no reason, if he is floating at 40% for 3 months, to go to the polls to vote for him.
Well, here's I think you're right. I think that the exit polls, however, will show that he got, quote unquote, 85 to 90% of self-described Republicans who vote. I think there will be a lot of Republicans who don't vote. But of those who show up at the polls, he'll get around, you know, 90%. Mitt Romney got 93%. It's not really remarkable to get 90% of the Republican vote. It's something that you have to pass as the threshold just to be competitive. But what we're seeing now, and this is such a really small, modest group of holdouts, Republican recalcitrants, who are still refusing to get on board the Trump bandwagon, but they are generating an enormous amount of attention on the part of Trump supporters at this point, because they know it's too late. They know they've lost the base. And they know that they're not going to win the election, I think. So now we're in the point at which we're blame-shifting and seeking some sort of respectable out for having covered for what Donald Trump always was and what he's now showing himself to be. And that has to fall on the shoulders of people who saw it a long time ago.
I may be wrong about this, but regarding the question about his larger Republican support, hasn't he been losing consistently support of college-educated Republicans?
Yeah, for the first time in like almost 60 years, something like that, yeah. That Republicans are going to lose the white college-educated vote.
Right.
For the first time since Eisenhower. Yeah.
So the circumstance is that he's shaken up his campaign. Gives a speech about terrorism, in which the only policy pronouncement was that he was going to toughen up a questionnaire. I mean, think about that. The policy proposal in his big foreign policy speech was that the questionnaire that is offered to people who want a visa is going to be really a lot tougher. This, we have come to this pass. This, after all of this noise and the Muslim ban and the this ban and the no, you know, temporary elimination of all visas and, you know, not letting people in at airports if they're American Muslims on vacation in another country and whatever else was said at the time that he floated that after the San Bernardino shootings. And now what we've come to is a really a better questionnaire. I mean, that also shows you, by the way, a certain kind of, I would call it paucity of vision, but it's not even paucity of vision. This is how amateur hour, I mean, beyond amateur hour, the campaign is. You know, at this point in any rational, conventional campaign, there are 50, 60 people working full-time on things like foreign policy position papers, so that when you need to flesh out your proposals, when a reporter says, well, what are you going to mean by that? Then you send them a fact sheet with, you know, 15 different things, and we're going to use this act, and we're going to activate that provision, and we're going to go to Congress for this, all of which may be boilerplate and noise and nonsense, but at least it puts meat on the bones of anything. And there is no meat on the bones of anything because there are 11 children working on this, 11 whiny children working on this campaign who are working for a 70-year-old whiny child themselves.
What was the best part about that foreign policy speech is there was almost no foreign policy in it. And there's almost no foreign policy in this campaign. It was very much a series of defenses of his past positions and his past rhetorical overreach, which, by the way, he has a digression. He has a weird tendency to say something silly on the stump, and then it becomes policy. They have to build out a gaffe into something that's policy. He has a very bizarre tendency to refuse to withdraw from losing engagements, which is something that is an obstinacy that is a very dangerous quality in a candidate for the presidency. But he's also just expressing how little interest he has in foreign policy, to the extent that it's not walling off the United States from a very troubled world. He's just disinterested in it.
I mean, then you go to the other policy speech, which was last night, where he spoke to some degree about the issue of police, civil community relations, and made what was in broad outline, a perfectly rational argument that most people in troubled neighborhoods where these things are going on are simply want a better life for themselves and their children. They don't want to live around crime, and what they would prefer is more security and more police presence, not less, and that it's a small minority of people who are creating this kind of activist frenzy. What strikes me as interesting, and these are important points, and, you know, they've been fleshed out by commentary contributor Heather McDonald and others, and Heather has a best-selling book out called The War on Cops, which I commend to your attention. But, you know, the world that Trump is describing or is attempting to describe, is attempting to grasp about, you know, his portrait of the United States, which, you know, came out in his convention speech. It was now going really sort of tried to hook to this issue of what's going on with the cops. The world that he is describing, which is a sort of a Hobbesian state of nature world in cities where, you know, everything is now, you know, turned into ashes and sackcloth, and it's all sort of terror. Everyone lives in a state of terror, is so utterly preposterous that I can't even think straight. Like, we have a cover story coming out in Commentary in September called Is It 1968 by David Frum. And just to point out what it was like when Law and Order helped get Richard Nixon elected in 1968. There were two assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Neighborhoods from L.A. to Chicago to Washington, D.C. to Memphis to Atlanta, all over the country, there were riots and fires that lit neighborhoods up. There were National Guard troops on the streets in 20 cities in 1968. There was a massive crime spike. There were, you know, people were deliberately, you know, setting fire to cars and beating up firemen, you know, like firefighters. the New York City in Bushwick, somebody would pull a fire alarm, the fire truck would arrive, and these guys would set on the firemen and beat them up. Firemen, not cops, not, you know, what did a fireman ever do to anybody? You know, living in New York City in 1968, 1970, 1970, 1974, you walk down the street in any neighborhood, in fancy neighborhoods, in bad neighborhoods, everywhere, and you lived in a sense of total menace. You didn't know if everybody got mugged. You didn't know if you were going to get in trouble. You weren't worried about being killed. You were worried about somebody holding you up at knife point. You were worried about someone burglarizing your house. So now we have crime spikes in Chicago, in 17 cities, and it's bad. But it's all isolated. A lot of it is, and it is awful that it's isolated solely to black neighborhoods, so that it were, you know, minority neighborhoods, so that people are preying on each other, you know, who should have commonality with each other. But people who live in Chicago are not walking around the near north side of Chicago fearful that someone is going to shoot them in the head. That's just not true. And it's not true if you live in a suburb of, you know, Milwaukee, that when the stuff is going on, if you live in Whitefish Bay outside Milwaukee, you're not worried that someone is going to shoot a cop in Whitefish Bay. It's not true. So he is attempting to capitalize on a set of fact by parodying them beyond belief. And that's one of the reasons I think that the campaign is going in the reverse direction, because to a majority of Americans, what he is describing as the condition of America does not comport with what they see before their eyes.
I would submit, frankly, that this is kind of a mirror image of what is going on in communities like in Milwaukee, which are tearing themselves apart now over racial anxieties, much of which are fabricated. A whole lot of the reason why Milwaukee is tearing itself apart now is based on the presumption, without any evidence, that there was some sort of a racial killing by police. And there's a lot of people saying that they have evidence that they're prepared to release that suggests that's not the case. This isn't the first time this has happened. We've been seeing a lot of this in these inner cities. And frankly, it would have been a stronger message for Donald Trump, who said, he said bizarrely that he implied, basically, that Rudy Giuliani's approach to crime management and neighborhood redevelopment in the 1990s should be exported across the country to urban centers around the country. Guess what? It was. We did that. We've been exporting New York City's crime control policies under Rudy Giuliani across the country for the last decade. Part of the reason why we're seeing a spike in violence now is because it's so historically low. It's been lower than it has been since 1993 in a lot of places. So what Donald Trump could have said is that there's this bizarre myth that's occurring in African-American communities that there is a real systemic racial aspect to discrimination. Now, that's not to say that there isn't discrimination. The DOJ cited Ferguson police officers for targeting black residents to fill the coffers with undue parking tickets, for example. And the DOJ's report on Baltimore is infuriating, the notion that they've been creating and fabricating charges in order to just get people off the street that they don't want. And this is some real racial discrimination. But that's not indicative of the nation. It's exceptions that prove the rule. And Donald Trump could have made that case and made it pretty eloquently, and I think that would have helped him a lot. But in doing so, he would have to say that half the bunk I'm peddling is nonsense. That's what he's saying he wants to do. He wants to keep, you know, the Breitbart Bannon narrative, this fiction world that they've created for themselves, alive and thriving.
Right. That was Noah Rothman, assistant online editor of commentary, Abe Greenwald.
Yeah, and then it's this thing where then the whole debate, both sides, become detached from the facts on the ground. Both sides are now, it's just about these competing myths. You know, and it also has to be said, the candidate, Donald Trump, who says that he's the law and order candidate and is now sticking with that line, is also the same man who said last week his sort of biggest gaffe to date, which we haven't even touched on. He's the one that told quote unquote Second Amendment people that perhaps they could take matters into their own hands in the event of a Hillary Clinton presidency.
Yeah, well, I mean, all of that thing, and then of course, you know, encouraging people to beat people up at his rallies and that sort of thing. I mean, yeah, he is the worst possible messenger for a law and order message, since he is the lord of misrule and disruption, exactly, and all of that. You know, what Rudy Giuliani did things that he didn't discuss. I mean, he put in place data systems in order to ensure that everybody knew where the crime was, where crime was going, and how to intercede so that crime spikes would stop. And then precinct commanders and police were put on notice that they were being watched and being judged on what was going on in their precincts on a week-to-week basis. But that wasn't the only thing. And one aspect that, again, Trump doesn't know how to do properly is that Rudy also sided with his police force against racial hustlers who were always trying to use individual cases of, you know, of police tragedies. And there were six or seven famous ones in which the police mistakenly and tragically did something wrong to someone and then say that this was the system, this was the true face of the NYPD. But, you know, no one in New York bought into this because crime had fallen 60%. It didn't work to attack him because the results were so staggeringly obvious. And as Noah, you just said, in a world in which urban crime is now, it's not a total memory, but I mean the nature of urban crime is so transformed that it is very much the exception rather than the rule. In those circumstances, when you're not in New York City facing 2,200 murders a year and then you bring it down to 800 or 700, and now it's like, now 15 years after Giuliani, it's now down below 400, 500, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. But when no one is getting shot and then, you know, no one is getting killed in a lot of these places, and then something happens to a suspect in police custody, it's striking because, you know, there doesn't seem to be a reason for police to be that aggressive with people as a general rule. Now, Heather McDonald and others would say that is not the police are still at the same risk on a day-to-day basis. They go out and they're facing criminals, and criminals have guns and weapons and they don't listen. And police are not sacrificial lambs. They're not supposed to stand there and let themselves get shot, which people seem not to understand. And it's also not like they're all sharpshooters and snipers. So what they can do is shoot someone in the leg or shoot someone in the hand. In fact, police, as I understand it, are trained to shoot people in the trunk of their body so that the bullets don't go off and hit some bystander. So you're not actually supposed to pretend that you're shooting someone. This is all movie nonsense. And so we find ourselves in a position where the war on cops, such as it is in part a result of success, not failure. And the danger, of course, is that because of two decades of success, we're going to forget what made the success. And there's a classic cyclical pattern in which it starts seeming as though enforcement is too draconian and the rules change. And when the rules change, crime goes up. And people are now saying openly, they're saying, look, that's intellectuals and people who are pushing for changes in prison sentences and mandatory minimums. They're saying that we accept the notion that there is going to be a spike in crime because of this terrible societal unfairness that so many black males in particular are in jail. Having said all this, and again, on the one hand, Trump is like yelling and screaming about this in terms of crime and black communities and all this. And on the other hand, he's also kind of an enabler of the societal disorder and social decay in these white working class neighborhoods of which he is the tribune, right? Why is he talking about how, you know, he talks about the opiate epidemic, and then he basically says it's really sad that there are all these people on opiates and it's really bad. But does he explain? Do they go into what's gone on in American society that explains why this is going on? Why these families are, why the white working class is no different from anybody else in their...
That's a perfect point of where his campaign myopia exists, because when he does talk about that, he says it's a border crisis, is that this is the result of heroin coming over the borders, and it's not. We're talking about the misuse of prescription drugs. The opioid crisis is oxys.
Right. I mean, not just that. So it's also that, you know, they're full of despair because the immigrants took all their jobs, or they're full of despair because globalization took all of their jobs. And, you know, I'm going to say one mildly controversial thing, which is I grew up, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and the general view was that people who worked in American factory assembly lines and in heavy industry were being screwed by the jobs that they had. If you were a coal miner, you got black lung and died. If you worked on an assembly line at an auto company, though you might or might not have made good money, the repetitive nature of the work was incredibly dehumanizing, and also you got repetitive stress injuries and things like that. And this notion that we're now looking back to these jobs as though they were the most wonderful jobs in the world, and if only we could get those jobs back. What was important about them was that you could do them without being educated. That was the issue, that you could have a high school education or not even have a high school education, and you could somehow climb into the middle class through the sweat of your brow, which had never happened before in America, in, you know, world history, and was in fact, it looks like now, an artifact of a very specific moment in time when America had 60% of all industrial production in the world because Europe and Japan had been destroyed. And once Europe and Japan were reconstituted, that was when this, you know, 20 years of glory, when an auto worker could end up making $65,000, $70,000 a year and own two houses, started to come to an end.
Well, I mean, I have another point that I want to ask you, a question that I want to ask you people, but I do think that there's a lot to be said for the fact that manufacturing is coming back a little bit, and we're kind of ignoring that, that manufacturing, particularly in automotive industries and even textiles, is coming back in places like the South, particularly because, and this is the great irony of all this, one of the most effective Republican reforms over the last decade has been to increase right-to-work legislation in places where you never thought it would be, in the industrial Midwest, where you now have the right to say whether or not you want to join a union. And that has prompted a lot of a rise in manufacturing and education, less occupations. And we're ignoring that in favor of, again, as you said, this bizarre fantasy that everything is terrible and getting worse.
I also want to, you know, I turn on the TV on Saturday night here in New York, and there was a movie on Channel 13 called All the Right Moves with Tom Cruise, his second movie, starring movie, came out in 1983, in which he plays a high school football star in a steel town in Pennsylvania. 1983, that's 33 years ago, right? And what's the plot of the movie? The plant is closing down, his brother is out of work, they just laid off 900 people. This line that Trump is proffering about the white working class and the jobs that have disappeared, this is a 35, 40-year-old American cliche. In other words, like those jobs, most of those jobs disappeared a generation before we began talking about this in 2015. You know, the steel industry largely shut down. I mean, now it's, I mean, it, or it shrank to this tiny, because it became so much more productive, among other things, and there were other places to get steel and all of that. There is some aspect of this in which he is playing on pop culture themes. Billy Joel's song Allentown came out in 1982. That's 34 years ago. They're closing all the factories down. Right, we're living here in Allentown. They're closing all the factories down. The jobs aren't coming back.
Line, yeah, filling out forms.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, this is all we're like having, as Yuval Levin says in his book *The Fractured Republic*. We're having like this is a nostalgia conversation. This isn't a present day conversation. This is a problem almost two generations old. So, which brings me back to my point that I made in the thing I wrote called A New Theory of Trump and Commentary, in which I said all of these explanations to explain the rise of Trump don't deal with the main elephant in the room, which was the fact that in 2008, we had a financial meltdown that had that cut the values of 401ks by 35%, and you know led to the fact that enormous numbers of people were underwater in their mortgages and couldn't get out from under them, and they're only just now coming back to par. But basically, their wealth was they lost their wealth and seven or eight lost years of wealth production and wealth growth is the reason that Sanders rose, and it's the reason that Trump rose. And we're looking for all these solutions, and there is no solution because the problem happened already, and we're still working it through this slow growth and every, you know, excess, fact that we, whatever.
So, right, well, and if I remember your piece, and you said that this is the reckoning, you know, yeah. or there never was a reckoning. But now if Trump was to be the reckoning, he's going to lose. There will never have been a reckoning. It will just have sort of gotten folded into history.
Well, if he loses, there shouldn't be a reckoning. We've already had the reckoning.
Right.
The reckoning happened, and then we're having sort of a little, you know, an ill-fated revolt against that reckoning.
Right.
Yeah, but you know what Trump will say when he loses. He'll say he lost and he got more votes in losing than George W. Bush got in winning, and so he got more votes. Because, you know, in the first election, George W. Bush got 50 million votes. And if Trump gets 50 million votes, he'll lose by 15 million. He'll lose by 15%. So he'll get 52 million, 53 million votes. And then he'll say, I got the second most number of votes any Republican has ever gotten. Blah, blah, blah. Sure, it's a reckoning. I mean, you have, you know, he got 44% of the Republican vote and won the primaries, and Bernie Sanders got 42% of the Democratic vote and almost won, you know, didn't win the Democratic primary, but he would have, but, you know, he came close enough. That's a lot. It's not majorities in either party, but it's the reckoning of people, you know, basically screaming primal screams in the political process.
Okay, so here's my question, my eternal quest for silver linings. Back to the Breitbart situation. This is a group of people who have convinced themselves without evidence that there are no consequences for losing elections on the Republican side. You can lose elections with impunity and nothing bad happens to you. That's obviously a myth. It's one they've created for themselves to justify their own ideological priors, and they're going to run screaming headfirst into this loss. We have an island of misfit toys here. They're all gathered in one place. At what point is there a way we can cordon this thing off and really, you know, quarantine what has become this disease on the Republican body politic that is leading itself into a cyclical cascade of self-doubt and self-sabotage? Are these people setting themselves up for their own marginalization?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that Americans don't like, as Donald Trump can tell you, is they don't like a loser. You can sort of have sympathy for a loser or feel sorry for a loser, but think about the big losers who were the heroes of the, you know, masochistic, aggressive, passive-aggressive Tea Partiers, right? I mean, Aiken, Murdoch, Christine O'Donnell, Sharon Angle. Have we heard a peep from any of them for years? No, they were humiliated. They were crushed and humiliated, and their political... and their sort of their level of political involvement was wildly, you know, curtailed, and they made it clear that they did not have a key. They did not have the key to the, you know, to answering these problems. And so nothing succeeds like lack of success in that regard. That's not to say that, you know, in a world like Breitbart.com, you only need a million people a month to be visiting you for you to be a player and, you know, and sort of get your links on Facebook and all that. So there's a distinction to be made between the politicians, including Donald Trump, who are crushed, you know, in November following his playbook, and the entertainment media, the entertainment wing of the right persisting.
To that, I would say just briefly that I don't expect Breitbart to disappear or anything similar to that, or the rest of the sites around that universe that have their worldview. But in we have sort of a 2004 Daily Coast situation here. This is really the candidate of an ideology that was screaming into the darkness that the rest of the country had rejected. They had their candidate, they had their moment, they lost. And the legitimacy and the influence of a Daily Coast style candidacy, style of political agitation, was discredited and wholly discredited. You don't see Marcos anywhere as a result.
Right. Although people would say that the organizational methods that he pioneered, meetups and this and that and the other thing, ended up being of great help to the Obama campaign in 2008. Now, my sense of this issue about what happens and, you know, can the misfit toys be, you know, cordoned off and can the island somehow be isolated from everybody else is yes and no. Yes, because they have nothing to, they will have proved, I think, that they helped march the Republican Party off a cliff, and that's not a good path to follow. And no, because there is no superstructure to deny them access to people's brains and to party officials. And people are going to stand around, as people say now, there's all this like, well, you know, you have to figure out the Trump voter, you know, this is real, and we have to, their issues have to be brought into the, yeah.
That's why I think it's a great question. It's unpredictable, because I can envision, so Trump loses, and then people start saying, well, what we need is, or what might have worked, is an articulate version of Trump.
Right.
You know, so the issues are real.
So you had Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was a blowhard buffoon, and now you have his daughter Marine, who is much more polished, right? So that would be the, but we,
it's
there has
the
to
Rand
be
Paul
one
version of Donald Trump,
right? But there has to be one, and we don't know who that one is. But I mean, again, this gets to the ultimate point about the Republican future, which is, and the conservative future, which is, are we really going to become a, you know, is the right really going to become a protectionist, anti-trade, isolationist movement? Because if it is, then its precepts have been fundamentally altered revolutionarily by a losing presidential campaign that did not seize the imaginations of anybody more than the people who were seized by it a year ago. So he's had a year. He will have had 8 months since, you know, basically since he was the only story in town. And he has not expanded his audience really by one person. I mean, he still is on Sean Hannity. You know, he's still on Sean Hannity three times a week. And everybody who watches Sean Hannity will vote for him, and mazel tov to them. I mean, congratulations. Like, he doesn't need Sean Hannity's listeners anymore. He needs, like, people who watch The View, and he's not going to get any of them. I mean, or he'll get some of them, because that's the dynamic, and people don't like Hillary, and they won't like her, and they're going to vote against her, and they will vote against her and vote for him if they have to. But, you know, this is an object lesson in how to lose by not expanding, and everything that was put in the Republican autopsy in 2013 will have been proved to be correct. There's been all this scoffing, and then of course the joke is that the, you know, hack head of the RNC, Reince Priebus, who oversaw the autopsy, you know, is now basically a functionary of the Trump, has turned the Republican National Committee into the functional Trump campaign. By the way, totally not the way the RNC had to go. In 1996, when Haley Barbour ran the Republican National Committee and the Dole campaign was floundering, Haley Barbour's entire mission from June on was to make sure that Republicans held the House and did okay in the Senate.
And they were really successful.
And they were, and he held it. He didn't spend the money, but he was not part, the RNC was not the Dole campaign. The RNC was apart and separate, and this was its purpose. And so what Priebus did, you don't have to do. So I think we've reached another, you know, set of ranting that has brought us to the end of another week of hilarious comic despair. I hope you've enjoyed our high energy Spanglerism. political Spenglerism. And if you haven't, we'll try to cheer up for next week and talk about, you know, something more in, something softer and nicer, 20, like
2017.
The weather. Right, the weather, you know, Baton Rouge, stuff like that. Commentary Magazine, 71-year-old monthly of ideas and analysis and policy and fiction and criticism. Please join our conversation at commentarymagazine.com, where you get some free reads, and then we ask you to pay $19.99 for a year's subscription, have total access to our archives and everything that we write, magazine and blog. And $29.99 for a subscription that includes our beautiful monthly magazine with a fantastic issue coming up. David Frum on 1968, Noah Rothman on the liberal leftist efforts to promote political violence, brilliant package on Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, and his untold successes as a foreign policy statesman and as a political actor. A lot of good stuff. Please join us.
And Jamie Kirchick on matters that we were discussing.
Jamie Kirchick on the Putinizing of the American electoral system in 2016 through the now kicked upstairs Paul Manafort. So that's what you get if you come and subscribe. You can read all that. You can get the magazine. Got a fantastic, hilarious cover, which I'll be putting out on Twitter later today if you want to check it out at jpodhoritz. And that's it. So we'll talk to you again next week. Keep the candle burning.